On this episode of The Playbook, I have Dylan Jacob, founder of Brewmate and a member of the Forbes 30 Under 30, and the two of us talk about how he developed and sold his first company at 19 and then created a $30 million company by drinking his first beer. Join me for all of this and more on The Playbook. This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host, David Meltzer.
This is Dave Meltzer with Entrepreneurs The Playbook, and I have one of the younger entrepreneurs on, a true entrepreneur, Dylan Jacob, CEO and founder of Brewmate, a.k.a. the Dehydration Company. Welcome to The Playbook, Dylan.
Thanks, David. I appreciate you for having me on the show.
Oh, man, I was so excited to have you on because you address so many different challenges for entrepreneurs of all ages. You're a Forbes 30 Under 30. You're the EY's Entrepreneur of the Year in 2019. You got all the awards out there, but and accolades. But more importantly, you have a thriving multi-million dollar business. And I always like to explore, how did you accelerate the success and the lessons that you had to have learned along the way in order to create such a success? And I know you didn't start with Brewmate. It's not your first company.
Yeah, that's correct. So Brewmate's my third company, third true company. And then I've had a lot of like different side hustles along the way too. So.
When did you start your first side hustle?
Oh, geez. So do you want the long story or the short story?
Your choice, man. We're stuck in a closet here. You take your time.
Yeah, I mean, so growing up, I'll kind of start a little bit ahead. So my grandpa, he immigrated here from the Middle East in the 1950s. My grandma was actually a survivor of the Polish concentration camps and workers' camps and was rescued by the U.S. military and brought here as well. And they were prime examples of the American dream. I mean, they came here with nothing, no family, nothing but the shirts on their back. And both built thriving businesses in Indiana. Well, my grandma was in Philadelphia at the time. But my grandpa had a cell phone repair store. My grandma was a landlord. She had a bunch of apartment complexes and things like that. And so growing up as a kid, like my parents weren't entrepreneurs. And so I didn't really have any sort of influence other than my grandpa in my life that really taught me, you know, that you can go out there and make something for yourself, right? Like the only option isn't to go to college and to get a degree and to go work for someone, that like you can actually create value yourself. And so when I was growing up, I spent a lot of time with him in his shop, and you know, he would pay me, right? So it was like I'd go in, I'd help him fix TVs and VCRs and whatever.
But I have one quick question. You know, today, yeah. I talk about toughness today. You know, obviously we're in compressed times of uncertainty and a lot of people feel challenged and change. But it's interesting because I've always told my mother was the principal of the San Diego Jewish Academy. And I always say, you know, the one thing that I couldn't imagine is having a parent or a grandparent that survived the Holocaust, because, you know, how could you ever complain, right? How could you ever, and but yet they can teach you a toughness, you know, living in Indiana even, that nobody else ever could experience. And I would imagine even today, these lessons and the energy of toughness from your grandpa and grandma are an extraordinary factor in not only teaching you the vision of entrepreneurship and providing value, but of, you know, one of the things I think we're missing in today's world is toughness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they both really taught me that essentially anything that I wanted was attainable, and rather than complaining, trying to figure out ways to get it. And so that was something that really stuck with me. And so, you know, in fourth grade, like long story short, my parents, I ended up splitting up. My mom had full custody of my, me and my two siblings, and she was raising us off a minimum wage job. And so there was a lot of things, you know, we had government assistance, and I was in public school for the first time. Like I was homeschooled up until fourth grade. So, you know, I was going into school wearing raggedy ass clothes from like Goodwill, and I did not fit in. And I was like, oh, like I need new clothes, I need new shoes, I need this, I need that to fit in and make friends and be cool. And so I, you know, we lived in an elderly neighborhood. And so I started like a little landscape company. And so it was a way for me to really like help relieve the burden for my mom and just buy, you know, frivolous things that like I didn't necessarily need, but I did want. And so basically, like, in the summer, I would mow their grass. In the fall, I would rake their leaves. In the winter, I would do their driveways and the sidewalks and stuff. And so that was, like, my first, like, foray into it. But as a kid, like, I always liked to tinker with things. So from the time I was a child, I was like, I want to be an engineer. Is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a famous inventor, actually. And so I wanted to go to school for product development design, and ultimately, you know, do like some sort of industrial design. And so through high school, like, still I had multiple side hustles. Some of them got me in trouble. Some of them were above the book. And ultimately, you know, I, even through sophomore year, it was like, I am still going to be an engineer. And so my first like real company that I ever created was born out of, kind of what my grandpa did. So, he kept telling me that people were coming to his shop asking if he could repair phones and iPads and MacBooks and things like that. And so my freshman year of high school, this was like 2009, there were no repair shops in Indiana. So you had to use a program called Gazelle. So you like ship in your iPhones, through the mail, and it would take 2 or 3 weeks for them to fix it and then send it back. And so I didn't really want to do repairs like for people, because you only make like $100 on a repair. But what I found was I could buy broken devices for like $20 or $30, buy the parts, fix them myself, and then resell them on like Craigslist and eBay and other platforms for like $300 or $400. And so from then to sophomore year, that was all I did. I would buy up like every broken iPhone, iPad, iPod that I could, fix them, resell them. You know, by sophomore year, I was making like $20,000 a year. I had saved enough money to buy my first car. And so like at that age, I was like, cool, like I feel like a millionaire. And then all my hopes and dreams were crushed because a local company came in and started doing cell phone repair, like right dab, you know, in the middle of my hometown. And it was like, great. Like, now everyone knows that they can get their phone repair. So how am I going to deal with this? Right? Because people weren't selling their phones for $20 anymore. And so I went into the shop and actually made friends with the owner, and found out he was getting his parts from eBay. They were low quality parts. And I had already established a relationship with an overseas vendor, for really high quality, like A grade repair parts. So I started supplying him with parts. And then, by senior year, I was actually supplying over 150 repair shops around the US. I had our own Shopify store. You know, we had an Instagram page. I would scour Instagram for hashtags related to cell phone repair and then DM people and send them, parts just to show them the quality difference between what they're probably using and what we could supply. And still at that point, I was wanting to be an engineer. I was actually accepted to Purdue. I was interning at Rolls Royce. I literally ran this business. I was called GB Supply Company my freshman year out of my dorm. And then we doubled our business size. That December, we got a big contract with a large franchise company that did repair. And I dropped out of school. And then 4 months later, I actually sold that company to them. And then at that point, that was when I was like, okay, like I was going to school to do product development design and ultimately like to become an inventor and entrepreneur. I was already doing entrepreneur side. I just had to figure out how to go out there and like take a concept from paper and pencil to idea creation and ultimately like marketing it.
You know, it was so funny about you. I hate to interrupt because this is fascinating.
My favorite. I'm trying to condense it down to like a really short version because there's a lot.
Yeah, no, it's cool. No, honestly, people need to hear this because there's no overnight successes, right? Even when you're 25 years old and a Forbes 30 under 30, the journey just started earlier and the lessons keep on coming. But the interesting thing is, you know, I work in executive coach so many different large company CEOs down to startups, and very rarely do I meet someone that's an entrepreneur first and then an innovator. You know what I mean? Like usually you got the crazy engineer scientist, and like I'm spending hours and time and trying to teach them how to monetize their ideas. Like it's something realistic. You're the exact opposite. You come from, you know, like this Eastern European pragmatic sense of, all right, I just want to make money. I'm not making money doing this, so I'm going to do this. Supply, demand, buy low, sell high. Real simple. But somehow in your DNA, you have this artist side of you that wants to be an inventor, you know.
Yeah.
And so I just want to stop because it's really rare. I think it's much more powerful, by the way, to start an entrepreneur, understand how to connect the dots backwards to make the money. than just start out with these crazy ass dreams and never be monetized. So continue on. So now you drop out of school. Can you divulge how much you sold your first
business? I sold it for $100,000. So not anything crazy, but I was 19 years old.
It's crazy.
$100,000 at 19 years old.
I would have died of overdose if I made $100,000 at 19. So I get it. Yeah. It's a lot of money.
Yeah. So it's,
by
it's
the way, funny. My daughter is 18 and she goes to IU. So she's a freshman.
Oh, that's awesome.
So bummed. She's telling me she's going to drop out until she can go back to school because she doesn't want to waste any time being away from the school because it's so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everyone that's there loves it so much and like to have to go full remote. I mean, I've seen so many people that are bummed out. They're missing graduation and stuff. So it's definitely a crazy time. And I don't blame her at all for wanting to wait and go back. She can actually get the full experience. So.
Right. Anyway, so now they sold that company. Now where are we?
Yep. So rather than overdosing, I actually bought a house. So I bought a little, it was a 1955 farmhouse. I got it on foreclosure. It was a piece of shit. Like it needed so much. Am I allowed to cuss on this show?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure. I can tone it down if I need to. So yeah, I mean, I bought this house on foreclosure. I got it for $70,000. You know, the market value in the neighborhood was around $200,000. And I was like, oh, like, you know, I watched a bunch of HGTV, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to flip this house, you know, because I didn't know what I wanted to do next. I mean, I was always looking for something, but I didn't have anything. So I was like, oh, this would be a good, like, fun project to work on in the meantime while I figure it out and I'll make some money. And so, like, first wall I took down, like, live termites fell out on my head. And I have, like, a phobia of termites now. But literally, I turned from a three-month project to actually a year. And then my next business was actually born out of that. So when I was finishing up the kitchen, I went into a granite showroom in Indiana. They had about 300 different types of granite. I was in there for like 4 hours picking out the slab that I wanted. And then I was going to pick out the backsplash and I went to a local interior design firm. And I went in there, the tile selection was terrible. I went into another firm, the selection was terrible. I went online, I couldn't find what I wanted. And so what I found was there was this vast disconnect between the hard surfaces, so like quartz, granite, different types of hard surfaces you can get for your countertops, and then variations to match those for kitchen backsplashes. And almost every kitchen in the US has a backsplash now. And so what we did is I created a company called Vici Design, and it's a still functioning company to this day. But the idea behind it was actually creating the largest color selection for glass tile in the world. So we had almost 25 different color variations. So every color of the rainbow and the different shades within those different color palettes. And the idea behind it was creating tile that could be matched almost any surface that was out there. And it wasn't, again, it wasn't a massive company. It was something I was literally running out of my basement for 6 months, 7 months. But I kept a journal. So it's funny you mentioned that. It's like these companies, I always call them like stepping stones because I knew that they weren't the end game. The end game was ultimately to like create a product that I could take from like pen and paper to actually creating a product that is improving people's lives and like be able to walk around and see people using it. Like that was my pipe dream. It was like the equivalent of being on like your high school acting team and being like, I want to be a famous Hollywood actor. And I was doing really good in high school, but like I wanted to go to the next level and I just didn't know what the step was in between to get there. So I was running this other company so I didn't have to, you know, go get a job in the meantime. It was still something I was really passionate about. I liked creating, you know, essentially identifying like missing components of certain markets and then kind of just filling that gap. That was fun for me. So I was still getting enjoyment out of it, but it was still missing that like true innovation side that I was yearning for. And so I kept a journal and like everywhere that I went, everything that I did, I would write down like things that I wish were better about this. Right. So it was like, essentially like I kind of looked at the world in a negative light. It was like, what sucks about this product? What sucks about this venue? What sucks about the situation? How could I make it better?
And it's I got to cut you off here. Cause the smartest things I've done through my lessons is I actually hired one of the highest paid employees I have, a chief betterment officer. And I'm not lying, man. The entire duties, responsibilities are to look at everything from the way we, you know, have our toilet paper to every employee. He just walks around, listens to calls, does everything. And his perspective isn't negative. It's how can I make it better? He's like the BASF. So you're like the entrepreneurial BASF. You're always looking to say, okay, how can I make it better? And you're journaling it and learning and practicing, how do I make things better? So I love that. It's a great playbook lesson. Very few people have had that approach, but that's why you're who you are. So continue on. This is awesome.
Yeah, but I think, so that was something that my grandpa taught me, was like, opportunity exists everywhere, right? And so it was like looking at the world in a way that you're like, you're looking for opportunity, but you're also like, I guess you'd look at it backwards. So you're looking at things that could ultimately be better, and out of that, trying to find opportunity. And so I was always looking for ways to improve products, whatever it was. And then I would write out, like, not a business plan, but just a small job. Like, does a market exist for this? Who would the ideal customer be for this? How much do I think it would cost to make? Is it a viable business plan? And so for a couple of years, like even from my first company, I actually kept this journal. This wasn't something really new. And so while I was running Vici Design, my second company, I also turned 21 at the same time.
Here we go.
So here's where the fun begins. So I, there's a brewery in Indiana called Sun King Brewery. They have incredible craft beer, and they quickly became one of my favorite craft breweries, but all of their cans came in 16 ounce beers. And so I was at carb day, and I had a 4-pack of their beer. I paid like $15 for all 16 ounce cans. And every single time I would pull out one of those cans, I could only finish like half of it before it was undrinkable. It was warm because carb day, it's like 100 degrees. You're out by the track. Oh, yeah.
I lived in North Indiana, on North 86, right by the old Shapiro's. I know.
Exactly. Oh, really? That's great. How long did you live there for?
9 months in the Oakwoods, right there.
Okay. Only took 9 months to convince yourself to leave.
I've wasted so many beers without you, so trust me, I'm 52. Yeah. So I've been drinking legally for 31 years with a lot of beers.
Yeah, I mean, I always say that the story started there. It obviously started before, just like...
It's ironic it's carb day too, right?
Because yeah. People
are known for carbs.
but out of that, I remember I wrote down in my journal, and it was like, warm beer sucks. How do I like keep 16 ounce beers cold? Right. And this was like a product for myself. Like, I didn't even think this was a business idea at this point. This was like, I wanted to like try and come up with a way to keep my 16 ounce beers cold so I could actually enjoy them from the time that I open them until I actually finish it.
Which and over a lifetime would save you enough money to be worth it. So
yeah, literally. I'm like, I'll just invest the money.
Forget the business.
And so like, long story short, this was a side project in the beginning. This was January 2016 at this point. I had a fully crafted idea for the container that I was going to use to cool these 16-ounce beers. And at that point, I was like, okay, you know, I knew a little bit about digital marketing, not a ton, but I knew how to run like, very minimalistic Facebook ads, and you had to create landing pages, things like that. So I had a designer that I actually knew from Purdue create a rough 3D model of the product that I had sketched out. And then we Photoshopped it into people's hands in different scenarios and create a little landing page. And then I ran lead generation ads on Facebook and was like, if you hate warm beer, this product is perfect for you. Like, it's designed to keep your 16 ounce beers cold, you know, to the last drop. Something really simple. But it was like, sign up to be notified when it's available. And we ended up collecting a few thousand emails. I only spent a couple $100 to get the emails. And I was like, I feel like that's enough to like at least explore this on a different level. So I flew out to China. Something that I always try to mention is a tool called Port Examiner. So it was a way you can actually look up customs import records for your competitors. So I looked up like all the top tier insulated drinkware companies that were already in existence. So like at the time it was like Hydro Flask, Yeti, Swell, all making water bottles and coffee mugs and stuff. And I looked up who their manufacturers were overseas, and then I went and visited all of them. And so it was a way for me to like identify, and this is what I had done with my other companies, was to identify who my competitors were using. And not so much because like I wanted to use the same manufacturers as them necessarily, but because if I know a company is a $100 million company, and I know they have high quality products, then I know that their manufacturer is capable of, one, producing the volume that I would eventually want to grow into, and two, that they're able to produce the quality that I would want for my own products. And so it was a really good tool for me in all the companies that I had. I always try to put that out there. It's not something a lot of people know about. But long story short, yeah, I went to China. So this is my second time. I actually went the first time when I was 19. I went and visited all the manufacturers.
Did you go by yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. Both times. I used to travel a lot by myself. So I'd go stay in a hostel. I like putting myself in uncomfortable situations. So just meeting random people and having conversations. And you know, again, like I grew up homeschooled, so it was like a lot of social skills and stuff like that were kind of self-taught. So I really tried to put myself out there more than like a typical person would, just to make sure that I was like up to speed on everything.
Yeah.
But it was something that was really beneficial for me because it got me comfortable like doing things by myself. Not just traveling or whatever, but like being comfortable and confident in myself to like make decisions without relying on other people. And so, yeah, I mean, I think from there, the concept, you know, I invested a couple $1,000s in having like a really crappy mold created. It was I called it the MVP, but it was just a minimum viable product, which just means it's like the base product, right? Like no frills. It's not the final product that I was envisioning, but it was enough to like prove the concept before investing a lot of money into the final product that I didn't have yet. You know, my money was wrapped up in the house and my other business. I didn't really have a whole lot of money to play with. So I got this in. I think I ordered like 1,000 units for the first batch. So our first batch came in May. You know, we got a lot of really good feedback on the product and things we could improve on the product. Things I knew, some things I didn't even think of. So that was really cool. And that was my first foray into using customer feedback to create a perfect product. This will be important for like a little bit later. And so that at that point I was like, I'm onto something, but I didn't know that it was going to be what it is today. Cause again, like we had done like $20,000 in sales and I'm like, okay, this might be something, but I don't really know. But I took that money and I reinvested and I was like, I'm going to invest in the molds to have the final product created. And then from then it was like 7 or 8 different versions, almost a year before we launched the version 2 of the Hopsolator. And in that process,
were you still selling version 1? Did you still?
No, we sold out. So I didn't keep getting it. I just told people to sign up to be notified when the new one came in. Anyone that ordered the first one and wasn't happy with it, I gave them like 50% off on the new one. You know, and basically just thank them for like being a part of like the initial launch and stuff. So it's almost like a Kickstarter without like, you know, giving platform fees, and, you know, having to do the whole, like a lot of people spend $30,000 on a Kickstarter campaign for the marketing and everything else. And then it's like, you could have used that money to get the product in the first place. So like that summer I was in Florida and, we had a bottle of wine with us at the beach and I got a ticket for having glass on the beach. It was a glass free zone. And I was like, oh, like I could create a product that would allow you to take wine in glass free zone. So in order to do that, I have to get rid of glass. So I created our wine slater. So it's a insulated wine canteen. You pour the wine directly inside of, and then it'll keep it at the perfect temperature range for over 24 hours. But more importantly, it allows you to bring it into glass free zones. So beaches, campsites, concerts, festivals, parks, wherever glass can go. And that product, I did the exact same thing. I created really, you know, just a CAD file for this. I had a designer. I paid a couple $100 to Photoshop this into people's hands. Created a landing page. We collected 7,000 emails this time. And we launched that product November 2016. So it was the day after Black Friday. And in 11 days, we did $300,000 in sales. And I was like, okay, this is something. I sold my house. I put it up for sale 3 months later. I got rid of my other business. Actually sold it to my dad. He was looking to retire. And I was like, hey, like take this. I have something else I'm trying to focus on. This is all you. So he took over. That company still runs. He's still, you know, quotes retired. He works a few hours a week running this and it pays for his bills. So he's happy. I'm happy. But at that point, that was when I was like,
Did you make a profit on your house, by the way?
Well, yeah. I mean, people are always like, oh, wow, you made $40,000. I'm like, yeah, but after like paying realtor fees and everything else, right. And then the time.
The emotion more than the time.
Yeah, a full year from like 7 a.m. to like midnight every night of like, you know, not only like studying YouTube videos, like I took electrician tests. Like I was pulling permits myself and running electric and doing like all these things because I literally couldn't afford to pay people to do them.
Yeah.
And it was like the most stressful year of my life. Like I'll never do it again. Yeah. I actually rent a house right now. And if there's anything wrong, I like call the landlord. I'm like, I'm not fixing anything ever again.
I'm over it. It's so funny. When I lost everything in 2008, I told my wife, I'm never going to own another property. And it did take 13 years and we have a few, but it was so freeing to be able to call somebody else to fix something.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, especially as an entrepreneur, like when you have so many other things going on, like the last thing you want to worry about is like, how am I going to mow my grass? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that?
I have a philosophy, just so you know, if I don't want to do something, I'm going to pay someone. Like, if I could pay someone to worry for me, I'd pay him to worry. So like, I figure out the math to everything, going, okay, how much is my time worth? And, you know, I'm going to pay somebody else, because my goal is to make every minute of my day worth so much that I can afford to pay anybody to do anything, because every minute's worth so much to me, including having a chief betterment officer, right? I'd rather pay someone because the margins get so big for someone to have their eye on what I'm doing and could be doing better and what the company could. So anyway, so, you know, the company now, you obviously, that if you have listened to this so far, and we're way over my normal time, but I had to let it go because so many nuggets and lessons. The irony is, you're probably one of the youngest, most successful entrepreneurs that I've had on here that is not an athlete, right? That's easy to say, but you know, it's extraordinary the way your mind works to fulfill a need and to provide value, to codify things and to think through. You know, there's a few key catalytic events by being more interested than interesting. You take the extra step where other people want, you know, like finding, you know, where those manufacturers were, going by yourself. You know, when I was your age, I was a millionaire by selling. And I actually had a place in Indiana at that time. And, but like I was too chicken. They were selling homes in Carmel, which you know there. And the four bedrooms were going for about 80 grand. And I knew, because I had a mind like yours, I knew all day long, my company was paying me $2,500 expenses to live in that Oakwood. Yeah. Right. And that was a stipend I could have. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, in 9 months, you know, I have a down payment, first time home buyer. I had it all figured out that I could rent it out. And they go, those homes will appreciate in my lifetime. Right. That was a lot of money, but I was too chicken to do it by myself. The last point I want to make that we haven't covered is really challenging for entrepreneurs is when to take money. What I love about your story, and you know, you guys do over $30 million in revenue. You are a Forbes 30 under 30. You've been honored by Ernst & Young as their top entrepreneur. I mean, all types of great accolades. But the coolest thing about it is everything you did, you know, you asked for help, but you learned yourself, including you took no money in ever. You never raised any money.
So we're actually in the process of raising right now for the first time. But there's a few things, like people always ask, you know, cause like right now, for instance, we're hiring in a CMO role, right? And people are like, why didn't you hire a CMO 2 years ago, right? And I'm like, because I didn't tap out my potential until now. Like, and I don't think that you can make a good hire unless you actually know what you're hiring for. So like what I actually do is I write out like what my shortfalls are really as a leader. And then I craft job descriptions around like what I would like to have my ideal role. And then from there, I create a title out of it. So I don't start with the title and then create a description. I start with the description, go with the title.
I did that to find my wife. So when you get older, like I always say, my wife's not perfect. She's just perfect for me.
Yeah.
Because I actually, now one more quick thing too. Do you, when you say you write it out, do you still use pen and paper or do you type?
It depends. I like to use pen and paper for a lot of things. It's just ingrained in me. If I have to run any numbers or data, I use, you know, spreadsheets or I'll type it up. But for the most part, I sketch out pretty much everything that I do. And then I'll type it up because it's like you cross things out. It allows me to think more freely when it's written out. And then once I have it, then I'm like, okay, now I'll type it up.
You're amazing, man. Well, I'm going to leave with this because we have to, and please, number one, join me on an IG live in the next couple of weeks. Cause I like to ask some more questions and help some young entrepreneurs. We get a pretty good following. But through your journey, and I think you're 25 now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're getting old. Okay. but through that journey, in, you know, being raised with your grandparents and your parents, well, you know, applying today, meaning the circumstances that we're under today, there's a lot of change. A lot of people your age are terrified. You have a lot different perspective than most. You know, what piece of advice, considering your journey, would you give an entrepreneur today sitting in their closet, you know, quarantined? What piece of advice, should they be doing with their time and focus right now?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the biggest thing is like just understanding that entrepreneurship is all about baby steps, right? Like, there is no, it's not a sprint. And I know people hear that all the time, but it's really not. Like, if I, when I first started entrepreneurship, like where I am today, I did not think was attainable. And it was the baby steps along the way that like really taught me, essentially like the skills that I needed to get to the next level. Like, I hate to say it in that way, but it's like leveling up. Right. So I would just say, like, think a little smaller, not necessarily like, I hate to say like to stifle creativity, but like, I think a lot of people are like, I want to create the next Facebook. I want to create the next this or that. But what I find is that a lot of entrepreneurs start with something really small. They teach you the skills, like they teach you, page you how to like, you know, figure out if there's a demand for your product, how to reach an audience, how to like create a brand, like just little things that are important that ultimately will give you the tools. Like, just start thinking about smaller things that you can do to start generating some income, to start learning. It doesn't have to be reading or listening to podcasts or things. I find that being more hands-on, you know, podcasts, I think, in my opinion, are a fantastic tool for listening and picking out nuggets of like things that apply to you, but they are not good for, you know, writing down essentially like a playbook for, because it's a playbook, right? But like, but the playbook, it's like, you're not going to study your other teammate's playbook and copy it to a T. You're going to use it to your advantage and only pick out the nuggets that are important to you. And so I would just say that, like, as they're listening to things, pick out the things that they think resonate with them and you know, kind of use those, but don't necessarily try to copy other people's success, because no story is the same. And then just start small, like just go out there and get started. And from there, like, you'll learn your way. And ultimately, when you find the right idea, it's like when you find the right relationship, like, you just know, like, you know, it's the right idea, you know, people are going to love it. And you're not second guessing yourself. I haven't second guessed myself a single day in this company, because I knew I was creating something great. So I think when you know, you know, and if you don't, it's probably not the right idea or not the right time.
You're awesome, man. Well, this was absolutely more than I even anticipated. I knew it was going to be great. Unbelievable entrepreneur, Dylan Jacob. He's the CEO and founder of Brewmate, aka the Dehydration Company. We're going to have a much longer relationship, I could tell already. I have a few ideas in helping as well. This is Dave Meltzer with Entrepreneurs, The Playbook.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making The Playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with The Playbook.